Yeah.
Right? How did we get from BMW to orthopedic pillows?
Welcome to Bad Voltage.
Yeah, seriously. Yeah, exactly. It is. We are the rambling uncle at Christmas of podcasts.
Bad Voltage, Season 2, Episode 38. We are here, myself and Jono, and Jeremy is not here.
No.
The bugger's on holiday, can you believe
it? He's cavorting around Europe somewhere.
I know, right?
It's posting his fancy drinks and his posh food.
It's all right for the other half, isn't it? So, we needed a guest presenter.
Yeah.
And we've done this before, and we had a look around, but we've had a bunch of feedback on previous guest presenters, and one of people's favourites was...
Well, hang on. Just bear in mind that everybody who we did contact was busy.
Very kind, is it? So, welcome back to the show, Alan Pope. Hello, Popey.
Hello. No pressure, then.
Well, there is no other option. I mean, we love you, Mr. Pope.
I promise not to talk about dogs' bottoms this time.
Oh, goodness, I'd forgotten about that. Yeah, have Sony put out a new Aibo? No. So, since we don't have Jeremy, do we get someone else to do the And Now Bad Voltage thing? Should we get Popey to do it?
I think we should, yeah. Go on, yeah. Step up.
And Now Bad Voltage.
I think I prefer his version, honestly. I mean, our tiny, tiny compadre is not going to be happy about that, but it was... I felt like there was more vigour and verve in the way Popey does it.
Perhaps.
Maybe you could use Mycroft to simulate me next time. If you ever need it again.
I suspect we're now going to hear that cut in at the beginning of every intro from now on. Anyway...
I'm amazed that you're still married, given the fact that you're the voice of Mycroft, because it means that your wife could provide an instruction and, you know, it would actually follow it as opposed to the real thing. So, anyway...
On the other hand, she's now learned to not ask what beans are, so that's okay.
Yeah, because I will not shut up about beans.
Anyone who is unsure about what we're talking about, go to YouTube and type in Mycroft beans and watch Popey's video. It is comedy gold, at least for us. Not necessarily for the Mycroft people, but it's certainly comedy gold for us. We're going to do a whole load of news for this whole show. So why don't we ask our guest to start out with some news? What do you want to talk about, Mr. Pope?
Oh, gosh. Okay, so the first bit of news I thought I'd raise is that Debian are having a lengthy discussion about packages which have problematic names in their distribution. And
No.
Yeah. I actually heard about this because someone filed a bug about this same package in KDE. And I looked around and turns out someone's also filed the same bug in Ubuntu. And when I pinged the person who filed the bug, they said, "Have you not seen the conversation on the Debian mailing list?" And then I stupidly went looking for it. And sure enough, there's a lengthy conversation about the fact that there's a bunch of applications in Debian in the archive that have actually been there a long time. And they have boobs and other words in the name of the application.
Right.
It's pretty puerile and pretty base.
Right.
But they are there. And they're now having a lengthy to and fro about whether to remove them and whether it's the right thing to do to remove them or not.
Right. And is it because of the name? Is that the reason for removal? It's because of what they're called as opposed to what they do?
Pretty much. I mean, they're functionality-wise, they do something useful, right? But it's the names. And most of them are pretty along a similar line. They've got... things like boobs and hand job and stuff like that, it's just, 12-year-old me would probably have been mightily impressed and hilarity would have ensued when I did a first search for ob or something and this thing showed up. I'd gone, "Oh, boobs." But 45-year-old me, not so impressed.
But in a similar way that typing, you know, boobs into a calculator when you were at school was hilarious at the time. you know, where you turned it upside down, it said boobs, but then you discover other forms of more interesting comedy.
But my calculator isn't a software repository used by millions.
Exactly. I mean,
that's a show title.
Maybe it runs on a calculator. I think there is a package called The Fuck, and what it does is it's for correcting errors. So you type in a command. It's a terminal program, right? You type in a command and get one of the things wrong. Like you type git push, but you spell push wrong. Then the next command you type fuck push, and it corrects the previous command. It's really quite clever. And
oh, I see.
It never occurs. So it looks at what the previous command was, works out what it was you meant to correct, and then corrects it. It's quite neat. And at no point did the name of that bother me. Because, I mean, the important word that Alan used there is puerile. It's not that the names are offensive. It's that it makes the whole free software community sound like a bunch of sniggering 14-year-old schoolboys.
Isn't Purell that's free software phone that came out?
No, that's just been delayed, actually. Yeah.
The Purell Librem 5. They're going to be super cross that you said that.
It was a joke, people. Right.
But yeah, I mean, so are these names actually a problem? Yeah, I think they are, but I don't think it's a free speech issue. I'd have no problem with someone packaging a thing called The Fuck and it being in there. I can absolutely imagine that Software Center maybe has a little tick box somewhere saying don't show things with swear words in the name, so you can give the thing to your 7-year-old kid or whatever. That's a whole separate discussion. But I don't know things which just make the whole community look like sniggering schoolboys.
I think there's a it's different for each of these examples, and these are not the first examples of applications with stupid, in inverted commas, rude names, because I realize different people will have different definitions of what rude is, right?
And yeah,
the fact
exactly.
that there's this thing called fuck or whatever, that's just a word, right? Okay, it's a word that has meaning and can be used in certain contexts, like aggressively or amusingly, but the applications in this case, where they're all sexualized and they're all very much the kind of thing that school kids would find funny and probably, I'm guessing, not as amusing to women.
Yeah.
But I think that's the bigger problem. Not the fact that they're rude words or the fact that it's profanity, but it's just childish crap.
What's interesting
that's exactly
to me
the
is
point.
That,
yeah.
I mean, I remember, God, it was years ago. It's probably like over 10 years ago. There was, when I was at Canonical, in the earlier days of me being at Canonical, there was something about, I think it was some application that like scraped, you know, erotic images off the internet and, I forget what it was called, Sex Something, I think it was. And
was it
there
called?
Was a whole,
just make a note of that. What was it?
And there was some application that was in the Debian archive that basically scraped porn off the internet, or like soft porn off the internet. And there was a whole discussion about whether that was okay or not in Debian. And I didn't really keep up with the discussion, so I assumed that they'd come to some kind of conclusion. But I'm assuming that that hasn't reached a conclusion. That's why this is kind of cropping up again. Because to me, there is a difference between the naming of something and the kind of content that it's pulling. I can understand not necessarily wanting kids to get hold of applications that can pull in porn, for example.
Like
and there
browser.
Is, of course, and there is, of course, like the whole separate question around, you know, there is one thing which is porn, and then there is a separate thing which is, you know, hate speech or hate material, or, you know, and if, like Popey says, everyone draws their line in different ways.
Exactly.
You know,
so. And if you open the door to banning stuff like that, then you get a whole bunch of people who say, but there shouldn't be Bible apps in the Debian archive. But that's not this discussion at all. I think exactly as Alan says, these things like this, they are at best childish and cast the whole community in a bad light, and at worst offensive specifically to women, to new people wanting to join the community. And there's sort of a give and take thing going on here, where the deal is no one will complain and whine at you about free speechy issues around your app if you want to publish it, but your half of that deal is don't call a thing wee boob. right? Just don't. Don't be like that.
Yeah, but you can't stop that, can you? You can either... There's always going to be, in the same way that we've all experienced, in many cases, time and time again, when you're at a conference or you're in a bar or you're at a restaurant or you're at a social event, and there's always that one guy who makes jokes that are just... They're just cringeworthy. They're not necessarily hateful. They're not necessarily evil in some form. They're just really cringeworthy.
Right, but that guy you wouldn't invite round to your house. You wouldn't
exactly.
You wouldn't invite to another. You'd probably like not give them a black mark, but you'd avoid them and you wouldn't invite them to another. This is software that's in a repository that's been there for years. Like it's not even. This isn't just day one of them uploading all this wondrous software with super features and then now reviewing the name. This is stuff that's been in the archive for ages. Now we're thinking, maybe having second thoughts.
But that's the tricky thing, isn't it? Is that in the human being example, you can basically swerve around them and avoid them and just generally be. And we all do this when we go to conferences. There's certain people you don't want to tell them to go away, but you basically avoid. And what do you do with software? Because if you can't enforce really very easily a rule that says don't name something that's childish, but then maintain other levels of free speech around Bibles and whatever else. Like I don't think there's a solution to this problem, basically. You either get rid of it all or you don't.
Mm. I'm interested to hear what the listeners think who maybe aren't responsible, but maybe have children. Maybe different parents might have different perception. They might think, don't really care. Or maybe they think, yes, I will fully control this. I'm interested to hear what people will say.
Yeah, I mean, this is one more facet of a discussion which is going on all over the place at the moment about is defending free speech is fine, but as long as people attempt to screw it up for the lols, is it entirely beneficial, you know?
Well, and what's interesting about this is that, we've seen, for example, with the whole Alex Jones InfoWars thing with him being deplatformed, where, there are some people arguing that this is an invasion of free speech. And I think most people, myself included, are saying this isn't an invasion of free speech. These platforms are deciding whether they want that horse shit on their platforms. And they're deciding no. And, that's one thing for Facebook as a company to say we don't want InfoWars, for example, but it's a separate thing for a community to, because essentially Debian governance is going to have to come to a decision on this. They're going to have to say, like, is this something we want or not? In my mind, if Debian say, we don't want childishly named applications or we don't want overly sexualized applications, that's fine. And if you don't like it, go and use a different distro,
Yeah, I mean, Voltaire might be prepared to defend to the death your right to name a software boobs, but I'm not, and I don't think Debian should be either.
Next piece
of news, Mr. Bacon.
All right. Well, did you see that NVIDIA just launched some new graphics cards called RTX? And the thing that people keep rambling on about these cards is that they support real-time ray tracing. Now, this is something that's been... I'm not, by any stretch, an expert in anything to do with gaming or graphics cards or anything like that, but I've... For some bizarre, there are certain things I just tend to keep up on just because I have a casual interest in it. And I've been keeping up on what's been going on with real-time ray tracing for a while. And there's been various other cards that have attempted to do this. And one of the things that's fascinating is there's a video, and I put a link to this in our show preparation document that you guys can see. And maybe Aki can link to it in the show notes.
I will, of course, link to it from the show notes, yes.
But it's basically, Battlefield 5 is going to be the next Battlefield game. And it's a demo of how this real-time ray tracing applies. And the example there, for example, is there's a car and there's an explosion behind a tank to the side of the car. And because the rays are being calculated in real time, you see the reflection of the fire, of the explosion in the side of the car. And it's one of those things whereby, does it really change the quality of the gameplay? Probably not. But what's interesting is when you see this switched on, it does add like a pretty remarkable level of immersion and realism to it, which I think is kind of interesting. What's fascinating as well is that you'd expect that these cards are going to cost, thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, but they actually apparently have some relatively low-end one, which just comes in at about $400, something like that. So it's not just like the the 1080 Ti, like, you know, triple SLI kind of thing that you need for this. So
I found the video. The guy doing the presentation was more excited than I've ever heard someone be about illuminated pixels on a display. It was quite.
It's a bit infomercially the way you kind of react.
It did seem rather disproportionate, didn't it? I did think that.
But that said, I quite enjoy playing games that are quite immersive, open world games where you walk around, take in the atmosphere, maybe do a bit of construction, maybe shoot someone in the head, all kinds of things.
Just like real life.
But sometimes when they do an upgrade to the software, and they introduce new effects like better reflections on the sea or better light casting so that it reflects off buildings and the wood, the material or the stone reflects in the right way. It just helps your immersion in that game. And I can see how someone who's playing a game where you're, you know, fighting the enemy and there's explosions going off left and right and you can see it reflecting in a building window or in a car or something as they do in the demo. I can see how that will increase your immersion in the game and you will feel like you're there. And I can imagine this combined with like VR or AR where it really feels like you're there would be an exciting development for people who are into, you know, high quality detail graphics. I think it's fantastic. And it's amazing that this stuff is coming to desktop computers at commodity prices. Okay, high end video card prices, but still accessible. You know, it's a bonus payment or it's a, you know, it's something you save up a little bit of money for, maybe.
Christmas
it's
present.
It's not out the realms of normal people, I think. It's fantastic stuff.
But, or maybe you put it on your wish list, which is diverting into a thing we found out the other day, that if you look at most people's wish list on Amazon, it's all small things. El Baconio de Maximo has a Marshall amp on his for $724, which is ambitious, I'll say that, mate.
The touch that I really liked was that Amazon emailed me that and said to me, it's Jono's birthday in a couple of weeks, why don't you buy him a present? And top of the list was that Marshall amplifier. Thanks, Amazon. Thank you, Jono.
I tell you what, though, on that note, Mr. Pope, and this is going to make no sense to any of our listeners, but Mr. Pope sent me this, and it is, to describe this, the movie Ted, written and starring Seth MacFarlane from Family Guy. Alan sent me this little bobblehead of Ted, the teddy, and it sits in my office. And
oh, wow.
I love it.
Yeah. That's fantastic. I didn't remember
it's
that.
It's nice. It's mainly an earthquake detection device, because when things start wobbling, his head just seems to start moving randomly.
So my drunken Amazon order from a couple of years ago, when it happened to be your birthday, turned out.
You've got to have something on your desk watching over you. So yours is a bobblehead of Ted.
It's true. That reminds me, I'm going to have to go and update the wish list. Because obviously listeners are going to be clamoring to buy me something. Don't need a Marshall amp anymore. Got an Axe Effect.
I'm sure they are. I'm on the real time ray tracing thing.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
I don't know.
Meanwhile, back at the point.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know much about this because realistically, you don't need real time ray tracing for Monkey Island 2, which is the most advanced graphical game I've got. But the thing I didn't understand about this, they make a big deal about real time ray tracing, but doesn't it just mean this card is now fast enough to do that? Like, presumably there was a point at which they did real-time shadows rather than pre-computed shadows, but that's just, we've made a faster card and now it can do this thing.
Right? I bet your assumption of graphics cards here is that a graphics card is basically a circuit board with a really fast CPU on it, right? That's not how graphics cards work. They have various technology incorporated in them for optimizing different types of operations. Right, so I think what they've done is,
they've built a real-time ray tracing API that someone can individually call to say, we need to real-time ray trace this here. Do
I think it's called, off the top of my head, I think it's something like a Turing chip or something. I think it's called.
Do we have a button we can press when none of us has a fucking clue what we're talking about? Because I think I need to press it.
Yeah, we do. It's called the record button.
But what I wanted, I mean, I went and read a bunch of reviews of this, but unfortunately, this is one of those things where everyone writing about it assumes that if you're reading their article, you know what's going on here. Right.
Yeah.
So I read through a million reviews of people talking about how amazing it was and vertexes and all this shit. I had no idea what any of it meant. So
well, also just PC gamers, they're just a different, just species of people. Like with their ridiculous racing chairs and their glowing keyboards and their LED mice. Like it just, I've already had a rant about this in a previous show when I tried to build a PC that didn't have horrible Blackpool Illuminations LED shite on the inside of the case. Yeah. And it's like, oh no, you have to buy it and turn it off. Like,
I know, it's ridiculous. It's like, why do I want a PC that I can see from space? And I like posh cases, right? I don't want some beige box that goes under the desk, as previously discussed. Right. But I also don't want it to look like Thunderbird 2 every time I turn it on. It's ridiculous.
Funnily enough, just before we started recording, I was playing Rust with Will Cook, your friend Will Cook, who has literally just bought a PC, or just built a PC exactly like that, a Ricer gaming PC. And the first thing he did was install Rust, and then we both jumped on a Rust server, and yeah.
Rust is quite cool.
It is.
Rust is quite cool.
So that's the kind of game where I think this kind of thing, where you've got that realism, the immersiveness, it will be good.
I can totally see that. As you say, it being more realistic means that you'll notice things like out of the corner of your eye. You know, as you said, the example of fire being reflected in a window, that's something where you don't even have to consciously react to it. You'll just be like, oh, things on fire over there. Take it, because it's like being in the real world.
Right, and if that wasn't there, then that car would look like a cardboard cutout placed in the world. It doesn't look like a car. It doesn't behave like a car. And if you can make the lighting look like that thing is a real physical, tangible object with a surface and with, you know, bumps and dents and the doors half open and the windows half down and you're seeing reflections, then it's going to trick your mind into thinking, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like the gaming uncanny valley, isn't it? You know, right. you want to kind of get as close to that level of realism. And it seems like with a lot of games, like when people are, when they're really fast-paced, fast action games like first-person shooters, it probably doesn't matter quite so much. But I think for games like Rust, where you spend a lot of time kind of like wandering around and taking it in and observing the scenery, you have the time to enjoy that kind of detail, where you might not if it's, you know, going like gangbusters. So.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. I've been trying to learn a bit more about graphics recently. So I've been watching a bunch of videos about Blender. I'm mostly going, damn, this is complicated. I'm never going to do any of this. But just watching them for the joy of seeing this thing get created. And it's amazing. Some of the things that people create, especially these videos where you watch it sort of sped up a bit. So you can see them just drawing a thing and then you go, well, that looks okay. And then they suddenly turn on the correct shader or whatever. And suddenly it just, bang, completely realistic kitchen. Or whatever.
I love how you've just discovered 3D modeling software.
No. I mean, I was aware it existed, but I didn't know the detail.
3D Studio Max is amazing.
I'm aware electricity exists, but yeah.
Hi, Dad. Right? The fact that I hadn't looked into it, it's really interesting, I think.
You should look at some of the promo videos for things like Unity 3D and Unreal Engine and just look at the stuff that they show you that it can do in the next version. Those are quite fast.
That's the Uncanny Valley thing you were talking about. I mean, one of my favourite game trailers was for Assassin's Creed Revelations. And there's a bit which is, it's the beginning bit of the game, but I don't think it's an in-engine cutscene. I suspect a bunch of it was pre-rendered. But some of it's amazing. You've got, he's walking past a guy and it just looks like a film. Looks completely realistic. And then there's a bit at the end where the guy pulls off Ezio's hood. And suddenly now you can see his whole face. It just doesn't look quite realistic, but it just looked completely realistic when his eyes were shaded.
Do you think, I don't know if I'm misremembering, but I don't remember whether when Zelda or whatever game came out on the N64 or Super Nintendo, we ever looked at the cutscenes or the video that when those 3D things came out, I thought, wow, this looks totally realistic. Is it only now that we're starting to do that? I'm sure we've done this before.
I think so. Yeah.
I think people are going, wow, that looks real, but it doesn't act. Well, the point is that there are some things now where I honestly believe if you took a rendered thing and said, is this a photograph of a real thing or is it a computer? Is it actually CGI, computer generated imagery? Got to be careful here because I've been lectured to death by Captain Disillusion about how visual effects and CGI are not the same thing. But this is actually CGI, computer generated imagery, right? There are some things now where I genuinely don't think I could tell the difference between a photograph and CGI. And I do not believe that was the case on the N64.
Right.
No matter how much people said that's realistic, you go, which of these is a photo, which one of these is on the GameCube? They go, that one's clearly a GameCube image.
Right. You know, pointy tits Lara Croft. I don't think at any point anyone went, wow, that's really realistic, but it was better than a 2D sprite of Mario, right?
I think the thing is, back then, I remember when I had a Mega Drive, for example, and, you know, you'd see one of these, like, little cutscenes, I'd be thinking, wow, look at the size of that sprite. How did they make that move? You know, like, oh, wow, Street Fighter 2 Turbo Edition. Look at the size of the sprites. How did they make... Like, I think it was more... The technology, it was more like, how do you make that technology work within that context?
It's got four-layer parallax. That's amazing. But no one's going, it's indistinguishable from a Tom Cruise film, right?
Right. This is, like, the Mega CD had parallax scrolling or scaling.
This is the problem I have with modern video games. I love them and they're beautiful and I want to play them just because I love the technological marvel of being in the game. I'm absolutely crap at all of them and I will never finish any of them, but I just love being immersed in that world. It's fantastic.
By the way, one final thing that I know noticed, because when I built my little studio machine, and I didn't need a very decent graphics card in there, but I needed something for audio reasons that kept this, like, deferred procedure call rate down low, and I got, like, a Radeon 560 or something, which was a couple of $100s, not particularly beefy by any stretch of the imagination. I played Battlefield 1. It's the first time I played a PC game in about 20 years. Put it on, and the whole cutscene starts out, and then it gets to a point, and it looked like it had just frozen, but the music was still playing. I could hear these sound effects, and then I realized it wasn't a cutscene. It was the gameplay using the gameplay engine. And I was just sat there, and it was waiting for me to do something. It looked so good. Like, unbelievable.
Oh, wow. You can tell that wasn't online play then, because you stood there for 1 second and didn't get shot in the back of the head by someone you never saw.
Yeah. Yeah, by some 13-year-old boy who would inform me of my mother's sexual proclivity.
And then presumably install web boobs from the Debian archive.
From the Debian archive. It's a circle of life. All right, so should we move on?
So, slightly more serious piece of news here.
Yes, what's next?
Now, if you buy a modern car, you get a whole bunch of access from your phone stuff. I'm not sure if this is the case on base models, but it's certainly the case if you go and buy a BMW or a Merc or something like that, or a Jaguar or something.
Right.
So they come with, you know, you can download the app and then you can connect it to your car and you can do a whole bunch of controlling the car and finding out information about it, so on and so forth. I don't think it's quite James Bond levels of being able to drive the car from your phone yet, but you certainly can find out a bunch of stuff. However, when you sell the car... You do a private sale or you sell it back to a garage or something. That stuff obviously doesn't get removed. And most of the time, nobody knows to remove it. So you sell the car and then a year later, you probably still find you can connect to it, find out where it's been, you know, how many people were in the car when it was being driven, all this kind of thing. There are a little thing. So if you actually buy a BMW... and the new owner registers the app against the car, it will automatically deregister the previous owner. But if you buy a Merc, the new owner has to ring up Mercedes on the phone to get the old owner removed if they didn't do it for them.
Okay.
And I just thought, I don't know, do people actually use this stuff? I don't know whether all this you can find out about your car from your phone stuff is just a stupid tick list feature that nobody actually turns on. or what? And I don't own a modern car, but Jono, you've only recently bought a car, right? So presumably it has all this. A
couple of years ago.
Does it have all this whizzy rubbish, and do you use any of it?
We don't have any apps for our cars, so I don't know. I mean, you, there's always been that. There's that standard interface, right, that you can plug something into and you can suck out of it.
Nah, like not
diagnostics type stuff, but...
Yeah, but this is things like you can control the climate systems, you can call breakdown services about the car, you can you can get all the GPS and destination stuff from the built-in sat-nav and so on.
If you were selling a car, could you not just put a USB key with DBAN on it and DD zeros over the hard drive or something and then hand the car over?
Well, certainly the point is that if you sell a car and you want to remove yourself, that's not hard. You can just go into the app and go, remove me from this car. The point is that most people don't.
But in the same way that when people sell their laptop, they don't wipe all the data off. I picked up a second-hand laptop in a charity shop a few weeks ago, and the woman who previously owned the laptop, this laptop hasn't been powered on for 5 years. I turned it on, and there was all her photos and documents on the desktop.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't know. People just are crap with technology. I don't think this is necessarily the car companies doing necessarily anything bad. It's just people are shit at giving something to somebody else and clearing up art before.
This is why I brought it up. Is this just a caveat emptor thing when you're buying a car, this is now just one more thing you probably ought to be aware of and say to the previous owner, can you unpair yourself from the car, please, if it's got that stuff? In the same way that you go, how many keys were there? If there were two, I want both of them. But there's no obligation on the car company to make it easier to do that. If they only hand over one key and go, there was only one key, you've got no real proof that there weren't two and they haven't just kept one.
I guess once people start getting, people have smart devices in their houses, they have smart bulbs and smart home controls. I guess once those things are embedded into your house, the same thing's going to happen when you move house. You're going to leave that house and still have an app in your phone that can control the locks on your previous home, maybe.
Yeah, totally. I mean, if you sell an Amazon device, the name of which I'm not going to say because it'll hear me.
reach over and mute mine. Yes.
Carry on. Can't talk about the thing behind its back. It's really annoying. And you don't think to unpair it before you just unplug it, and then it goes to a new Wi-Fi network. Does it make you re-log in?
Well, so I have a second-hand lady cylinder on my desk. I when I first plugged it in, it's obviously trying to reach the wireless network of the previous owner of said lady cylinder, and obviously can't do that. So the first step is press a button to reset it and get it connected
of course,
to my Wi-Fi.
You can't connect to it from the mobile app until it's yours. And
until
in order to make it,
network.
You have to reset it. Oh, so that problem's actually solved for the thing.
unless my network was called like BT Wi-Fi, and I just happened to have bought one that had been on somebody else's network called BT Wi-Fi or something.
And I had the same password or whatever. But
wouldn't work, but yeah.
Ah, that's really interesting. So that's already solved, but...
Also, if you buy a car and some of that information is left in there, I mean, with the exception of the GPS, trips is you wouldn't want that sharing with other people, and you wouldn't necessarily want your home address sharing with other people. But in terms of all the climate control and, you know, car diagnostics and where your seat position is,
that's not that big
a
deal.
Yeah.
To be fair, when you sell a car in the UK, your home address is printed on a piece of paper that you give to the next owner.
Yes.
It's not exactly hard to get your home address. Also, I think my worry would be less that data when handing the car over. I'm more concerned about the manufacturer and operator of the car. If you look at some of the stories that are coming out of the US with Tesla owners, if they take a broken Tesla, there's a few people who take broken down ones, crashed ones, and recover them and fix them and put new front end on them or whatever, new batteries, and then try and get any kind of parts from Tesla, and they get turned down because that car is now on a block list and you can't actually buy parts at all. I saw a video, there's a guy called Rich Repairs, he's a very entertaining chap who does a lot of this, and he phoned up Tesla and said, you know, here's my VIN number. And all he wanted to do was buy little caps that go on the lug nuts on the wheels, and they wouldn't sell them to him because that car was blacklisted.
Really?
Yeah, because it was it had been in a crash and it had been recovered, and they have to certify, and you have to pay thousands or so of dollars to get it recertified, to get it back on the road. And if they say no, then you've got a car that works, but you can't get any service from them.
So it wasn't a cut and shut or anything. They're just basically going, unless you buy...
legitimately repaired car.
Or, unless you buy all stuff from us forever, we're going to refuse to allow you to buy any stuff at all.
Because there are only Tesla service centres. There are no third-party Tesla service centres. You can only go to them to get your car repaired. I'd be more worried about that my car was being held hostage by the manufacturer. Right.
And we talked in the last show about how the FBI approached Google and said, we want to find everyone who was in this area. And Google said no, because they're prepared to actually push back on that kind of request from law enforcement. Are BMW or Mercedes prepared to push back on that? Not. I suspect they're nowhere near as invested in pushing back on that kind of request.
By the way, I was thinking about that, and I suspect that based upon my prior experience of Google and their management of YouTube, if they were asked the FBI agents if they would be willing to upgrade to YouTube Red, and they agreed to, they would probably provide that information. YouTube, please stop it. I don't care about your stupid YouTube Red service. Enough.
Their latest trick is if you're watching a video and... I was doing the washing up and I started playing a video on YouTube, and then I locked my phone, and I'm not a YouTube Red or Premium or whatever subscriber. Yeah, I locked my phone and went to put it on the shelf and it stopped playing. I thought, oh yeah. So I unlocked the phone. As soon as I unlocked the phone, there was a pop-up saying, hey, do you want to be able to watch videos when your phone is locked?
Oh yeah.
You need to sign up to this thing.
It's infuriating that people have been moaning about the fact that YouTube won't play stuff in the background or when your phone's locked for years. And clearly the reason it hasn't is because they thought right back at the beginning, at some point in the future, we're going to make people pay for this feature. So we're not going to give it to them now in order that we can make them pay later. But at no point did they ever say, no, that's going to be a premium feature, but we haven't done premium yet. They just ignored everyone's requests.
Well, they have that right. They are a commercial company.
They do. It's just, I'm not suggesting they're not allowed to do it. I'm saying they're annoying.
If you give everybody what they want, then you don't have a company anymore.
No.
A revenue stream.
They don't have to give everyone what they want, but they could have said, no, we're not going to do that because that's going to be a premium feature later.
I just think it's the definition of a feature that nobody wants. Like, I think most people don't particularly care about the ads because you can skip them. And... most people don't necessarily want to play things.
Not on mobile, you can't. Mobile is very difficult to skip ads on.
Yeah.
If I'm doing the washing up and I've got a video playing, am I going to skip the ads? My phone won't do it automatically. I've got to dry my hands and then go skip, skip.
Oh, you've got to tap it, yeah. But you can do it, right?
But it's not like a browser on a desktop where it automagically does all of that for you. I know these do exist now. Sorry, Stuart. Yeah. I know they do exist, but it's harder on mobile.
Yes, but an awful... I'm experiencing quite a lot more ads which are now unskippable and 30 seconds long.
That's definitely happening more.
I think the thing about the browser and stuff on mobile is that's because you're using the YouTube app on mobile rather than using YouTube in the browser on mobile, because the YouTube app obviously doesn't have an ad blocker in it, not surprisingly.
I also ethically, as discussed previously, ethically oppose ad blockers. That's how the internet gets funded. So watch people's ads and then the internet gets funded. But the thing that bugs me more than anything about YouTube is just an efficiency thing. So to give you an example, Eric and I have been looking into buying one of these Peloton exercise bikes, and we've ordered one. And the minute I went to their website or did something that related to Peloton, I think maybe one ad kind of appeared and I clicked on it, and then it would just basically DDoS me with Peloton ads before every YouTube video. And it got to a point where, like, I've already gone and talked to the store about this. I already understand about it. I don't want to see these ads anymore. So I'd selected, you know, the downvote thing whenever I'd see it, and it just completely ignored it. In the same way that these freaking purple pillows, for some reason, like once a while back, I looked into buying a orthopedic pillow, right? And now I've been basically just harassed by the purple pillows people. And it's like, for them, they're paying for advertising. that isn't being, like, it's having the inverse effect that they want. It's irritating me that I see.
Technically, it's not. Because you're now talking about that product to, I don't know, tens of people.
Tens of people. But I'm talking about it in an annoyed way. And the thing is, the difference, I think, with us compared to, I think, most people of the planet is that we know how advertising on the internet works. So I know that it's not, I know that this is not so much Purple's issue. It's more an issue with YouTube. But the problem is, I think a lot of people, like, you know, would get irritated at the brand because they're being over-advertised to when they've said they keep skipping it or they don't. Like, my view is, if you skip something three or four times and you've pressed the downvote button three or four times, it is time to officially piss off, right?
I mean, I wish the Twitter... I wish Twitter would learn that. But the thing I don't get is, for some people, maybe literally all Google knows about them is they once looked at an ad for some orthopedic pillows and they once looked at an ad for some Peloton stuff. And therefore, that's what they know. But your whole life belongs to Google.
Yeah. Right?
How did we get from BMW to orthopedic pillows?
Welcome to Bad Voltage. That,
yeah, seriously. Yeah, exactly. It is. We are the rambling uncle at Christmas of podcasts.
So, should we move on? Yes, pick a different piece of news.
Go on, Mr. Pope. Give us something. Give us some sugar.
Okay, so this is less news and more a discovery that I made. There's a local Facebook group to me, which are mostly old people posting photos of how the world used to be and how it was much better back then. Most of the photos are in black and white and there are places nearby. And one of the guys posted a link, which was a screenshot. And the screenshot had two maps side by side. It was like an old map and a new map. And I looked at it and I thought, that's quite interesting. And it turns out it was a website, a publicly accessible website called NLS.UK. In fact, the full URL is maps.nls.uk. It's the National Library of Scotland. And it's a library where they have lots of digitized maps of not just Scottish land, but other lands as well, including England and some bits of America. And the really cool thing, the really coolest thing on there is this side-by-side viewer, where it'll put up two maps, an old map and the current overhead, like, Bing satellite view, and as you move them around and zoom in and zoom out, they move and zoom together, so you can get a side-by-side view of what this place looks like now and what it used to look like 100 years ago. It is super cool, and I spent like 3 hours on it last night just browsing around looking at various places in the UK. It's great.
It is. Yeah. It's very interesting. I have it open in my browser right now, and it's fascinating being able to just go and compare and contrast this, but yeah. Go and check it out, maps.nls.uk.
I even bought a map. I was that impressed that I thought, oh, I'll support these people. So I bought an A2 sized, like, you know, so that's 4x A4 map of Hampshire, where I live, from 100 years ago. And last night I said to the wife, if I buy a picture, whereabouts in the house can I hang it up? And she went, what kind of picture have you bought? I was like, it's not nerdy. It's not geeky. It's just a nice picture. And so we're now trying to find where in the house I'm going to put this thing. I think it'll probably be above my desk right here.
Is it going to be on the outside of the house?
Facing
the west.
It's going to be in the bin. In the skip across the road, yeah. The site is excellent. I did the same thing that everyone does, which is go and look up where they live or where they grew up. Which was fascinating, you know, because this they've actually got a whole bunch of different maps you can pick. The oldest one they've got some sort of 1890 or something, and then there's a whole bunch going up through the 20s and 30s and 50s and 60s and so on. And it's cool. One of the things it does teach you is how much better we are at mapping technology now than you were. I mean, the maps were amazing 130 years ago, considering it was all done by some bloke with a notebook and a lot of shoe leather.
They didn't have sufficient GPS satellites in orbit back then. That was the problem.
It was. The problem is that, you know, you need four over the horizon, and they never managed to get to four over the horizon in order to do the map. But you look at the maps now and you think, wow, maps now are amazingly detailed by comparison. You know, you zoom into where I am, and this building was here back then. It was a school back then, and the frontage of the building is still original. And so you can see a building, but it's literally just a black box on the map. Whereas now, if you look at OpenStreetMap or Google Maps or whatever, it's this incredibly detailed thing. And it's fascinating. You can see how many streets around you just weren't there in 1890.
I went around the coast and down to Dungeness Nuclear Power Station,
which
obviously wasn't there 100 years ago. it's just like all the little things that were there and being able to like scroll along the coastline and see. In fact, one thing that I thought was fascinating is you can see where the Coast Guard place was 100 years ago and where it is now and see that the sea has eroded the coastline away, so you can see it's closer.
Oh, really? So it's sort of further inland. Well, it's not. It's obviously on the edge, but the edge has moved in.
Yeah.
Oh, that is
fascinating. So, yeah, that's what I spent last night doing. So I just wanted to share that little discovery.
No.
One thing I'm fascinated by is going over the Thames, the River Thames in London, is that pretty much all of the bridges on it existed in 1885.
London's really old, man.
I found cities a bit less interesting than out in the sticks places. Like, if you go all the way down to, like, Land's End or somewhere like that, you can see these tiny little alleyways, and some of those still exist. And there's a school way down near Land's End that is near where I went on holiday, and that school was there 100 years ago. It's just...
Yeah. Oh, no, you see, I found cities to be excellent. I mean, obviously, I went and looked up Birmingham, right? And it's great being able to look and go, okay, well, there's Victoria Square, which is still there. Oh, and there's some other building, which is now Byron Hamburgers or whatever, and was not that in 1880. Right. But seeing that, I did actually see, and I must dig up the link for this, I saw quite a cool site where they would sell you a poster of a map, and it was a map done... pure white background, all the streets in just pure black. So no labels or legends or anything on the map at all. Just that as an overhead view. And then the name of the city, sort of Philadelphia or whatever, in writing at the bottom. And they looked really cool in quite a stark, minimalist sort of way. You can imagine having them on the wall. The problem is they're an American company. And the example maps they showed of all American cities... But if you look at British cities, they don't look as cool in that kind of map because they haven't got that kind of graph paper regularity. It just looks like someone got a handful of ink and just threw it at a page. Because I thought, I'd like one of these for Birmingham. How cool would this be? And then when I looked at it and went, it doesn't look that cool at all. It just looks rubbish. Whereas, you know, Arizona looked interesting.
Are you ready for an amazing segue?
Do it.
So, from pixels on a screen to pixels left in the back of a lift.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, that's right.
The fact that Google employees appear to have left a Pixel 3 within range of every journalist on Earth by accident.
So, as I talked about on, I think it was the show before last, I've been monitoring the Pixel 3 leaks pretty carefully. The Pixel 3 is expected to be announced on the 9th or the 10th of October. It's usually early October when they tend to announce these.
Are you planning to get two or three of them and a bathroom to throw it down the toilet as well when it arrives?
Now, hang on. while that may seem like a fair comment, it actually is.
Because it is.
I'm evaluating what to get next, and I'm wavering a little bit. I won't turn this into what phone I'm getting, because I've been looking at the OnePlus 6 and a few others. But what I think has been interesting is this. Do you remember quite a while ago, there was a whole news story about how some Apple employee left an iPhone 4 prototype, I think it was, in a bar in San Jose. And basically, Apple hit the roof about this, and rightly so, and there was a big problem about it. I think what's going on here is one of two things. Either Google are just the leakiest of leaky ships when it comes to the Pixel 3.
Spectacularly incompetent about this and nothing else, by the way.
I mean, yeah,
no one ever seems to leave the plans, the source code for Google Wave on a floppy disk in a bar, do they?
Well, people just leave it in the bar, wouldn't they?
So, I found it and no one cared. Throw it away.
To be fair... Apple are quite the opposite of being leaky. And so when something does leak out, like the iPhone 4 did, and it was a massive redesign, whereas the Pixel 3 looks like another glass slab with maybe more pixels on it. I don't know.
Right.
But the iPhone 4, the difference there was Apple are notorious for keeping things secret.
Yeah.
And it was touted around all the news organizations. So the person who found it or whoever it was passed to was touting it around, trying to get some money for it and a story out of it. And when I think it was Gizmodo published, that's when Apple hit the roof.
So what's interesting here is that with the Google 3, like historically with the Pixel leaks, it's always been around, you know, people get hold of the schematics for the cases,
right? Templates and stuff, right?
Yeah, and then there's people who will render them, and there's certain people who are known for leaks, such as EV leaks, who will leak various bits and pieces. But it's always been much and much the same. It's been really informed assumptions and guesses around this. The fact that apparently a box of Pixel 3s was nicked from a factory, sold on the black market in the Ukraine or somewhere, and people have been posting videos, and the fact that one was allegedly left in the back of a lift either suggests to me that they have terrible security when it comes to the Pixel 3, or, and this is what I think is the case, you've got two very, very capable social media professionals who are almost certainly called Brittany and Chad, because all social media people are called Brittany and Chad. And what they've done is they've basically archetyped, they've architected this campaign of quote-unquote leaks. And it's complete PR. And it's working. So what happens is, you know, Apple have got their announcement event in a couple of weeks. And then Google are always a little bit behind the trail on that in October. But we're all talking about the Pixel 3 because it's been hitting all of these 9-to-5 Android news sites and Android Police and whatever else. And I believe it's completely architect. Now, I sound like an Alex Jones conspiratorial
yes.
nutcase
yes,
when I'm saying this. But could it be that? I mean, I can't believe that their security is this bad.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. If you're going to be, if you're prepared to be open about it, then at some point someone's going to say, why don't we pretend we were going to be closed and then leak it? So everyone runs stories going, oh my God, leaked Pixel 3.
Well, in all these leaks, forgive me, all I've seen is the lift story and nothing more. Have there been any revelations about what's new in this device? The leaked lift one was basically photos of the front and back.
Someone left one in the back of a cab.
Yeah, the lift one, but it was photos of the front and back.
Oh. So Stuart, lift is it's like taxis, but for the modern era. You can use this application on your cell phone to request a ride, and it will appear at wherever you live. That's what a lift is, just so you know.
As I understood it, I believed it appeared somewhere near where you lived and then drove you four times as long as you need to, but you don't have to give them cash, so that makes it better.
But now they expect you to tip them.
What are the
revolutionary new things in this new device that aren't available in any other phone?
There isn't anything.
That's not entirely true.
So why are we talking about it?
Well, so first of all,
Jono wants to buy one.
I think what's happening here is there is some new stuff in it. To be fair, like you know, the Pixel 3 is one of the first ones with a notch, and there's dual cameras. One of the first Pixels with a notch is I'm saying.
Right,
so by definition,
they're late to the party there because Lenovo, Motorola, Huawei, and
always
many
late to
others
the pie.
Have notches.
Pixel is always late to the pie. There's two cameras on the front. There's some internals, which is relatively interesting. There's with the wireless charging in it. So it's new stuff for the Pixel line.
If your question is, what's new in it that wasn't in an iPhone a year ago, the answer is nothing as far as I can tell.
It is a thoroughly average phone in terms of new shit, but I don't think they ever try to be first with stuff. But my point is that the regular consumers are not going to go out and
charging,
know about this.
By the way, but that's not new to them either. At least they'll do it.
No.
But sorry, carry on, John.
But my point is that, you know, in many ways it's kind of a genius PR move because people are talking about it, but the people who are talking about it are the nerds, phone nerds, because those are the kind of people who are reading Android Police and whatever else. Regular consumers will hear about it when it hits their launch event in October. So, well, and we read this, and as we've seen from our current political climate across the world, people like to read salacious content, anything to do with leaks or whatever else. So, I'm pretty sure that this is staged.
Yeah.
But I feel weird for saying it because it does make me sound like Alex Jones.
No, I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing to believe, and I'm quite convinced by your argument. Just because I'd be surprised if they were this incompetent otherwise.
Well, I find it difficult to get excited about Google Pixel phones because they're just another slab.
Yes.
There's nothing special about them, and they're just like every other slab. Like you've mentioned the OnePlus 6 that's on your list of things you might be looking at, and there are other phones as well.
Yeah.
I just can't fathom what it is. Okay, it's got Google Assistant. Well, they've all got that now, as I understand it. It has a fairly recent version of Android. There's a few other phones, the OnePlus, Nokia, and a few others have that as well. I just can't fathom what this passion is for the Pixel, other than the fact that it comes from Google.
The only reason why I'm interested in it right now is because I'm in the market for buying a new phone.
Right.
For example, I paid basically no attention to the Pixel 2 because I had a Pixel. I was not in the market for a new phone. I don't understand how people get excited about cell phones because they're really not changing that much. And all of this whinging about the size of the notch or the size of the chin, most people just don't care about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's just not interesting. I mean, I can't think of a thing that cell phones, the mobiles have done for the last 3 or 4 years that made me go, wow, I really need that and I don't have it.
Right. So I went from the OnePlus X.
OnePlus X.
That was nice and small.
Yes.
For us lady hands kind of guys.
Hooray.
To the OnePlus 3T because it had more RAM and I wanted to be able to have lots of things open and not be culled while I'm switching between them because I switch apps a lot. Now I've got the OnePlus 3T. I can't imagine what feature I need in a next phone, which is why I've skipped all the ones since the OnePlus 3T. I just can't.
Yeah.
I'm having real difficulty finding anything, like better camera maybe, but
it's just, you know,
well, the camera's now good enough for most people. The main feature I need is a phone that's waterproof.
you really have you not thought about just ordering it from Google and having him deliver it directly to Bed Bath and Beyond and just cut out the middle, man?
Yes, pretty much. All right, well, we're about an hour in.
Yes.
We should probably do a couple more and then wrap it up.
Yes,
because
I agree.
The Pope has got things to do.
A quick one, which I just thought was amusing. Twitter decided they were going to stop setting things up so you can cross-post to Facebook. And it's not entirely clear to me exactly what caused this, but I think it's all tied in with Twitter cutting off third-party API access, which has broken every third-party Twitter client and... cutting off some parts of third-party API access and so on. But what was amusing was Twitter therefore removed their registered Facebook app. They had a Twitter app registered at Facebook. So they removed that, at which point every single cross-posted tweet was deleted from Facebook.
It was.
I wonder who was the first person to spot that. Well, and what their reaction was when they saw the data had gone.
Yeah, it has now been fixed, presumably because someone at Twitter picked up the phone and rang someone at Facebook and went, sorry, please restore from a backup or something. So, first of all, there's a kind of... But if I deleted my Facebook app and deleted all stuff, they wouldn't listen to me and put it all back. That's really annoying. But I'd just like to imagine whoever it was who went, fine, we can just delete that, we don't need it anymore. And then, you know, that kind of cold feeling of despair when you realise you've done something wrong and irreversible.
Depends on the person, isn't it? Whether they actually just went, oh, well, fuck it. It's gone now.
They are now back anyway, but I just thought it was... So this is why, Jono, when you were like, has it? Not anymore. They're back again.
I think this actually highlights the complexity of modern applications. Yeah. It's very hard to know. Like, when all you're doing is pressing a button that says, OK, cancel. Like, in the old days, you'd press a button and you know, I am saving a text file on a disk. Now, there's so many thousands of layers of abstraction and so many interconnected things. You press a button, you've got no idea the myriad of things that happen out there in the wide world. So I'm not surprised something like this was bound to happen.
I mean, banging on about, you know, remember people banging on about intertwingularity a few years ago where everything was connected to everything else and so on, and that was a really cool, desirable thing. Kind of, but maybe in retrospect, maybe we didn't want to weave everything in with everything else, so we've got no idea what the hell is going on.
Not when Jim, the new intern, is tasked with deleting the app from Facebook, no.
Yes. Do we have anything else? Do you have anything? I have one.
Okay.
We can maybe touch on briefly. So I'm going to read some of this from the from this article I read. According to a Microsoft Commission survey, 50% of parents in the US with kids aged 18 or under believe that coding and computer programming is to be the most beneficial subject to their child's future employability compared to foreign languages primarily, which are at 28%. From the Microsoft Education blog post, they said, when asked about the technology industry's involvement, 75% of parents said that they believe big tech companies should be involved in helping schools build kids' digital skills. And many companies such as Microsoft and organizations like Code.org are working to do just that. So I thought this was interesting. Like, one theory that I've had, and we've talked about on Bad Voltage a bunch, is that coding in schools is going to become a more and more prominent thing. And it's good to see that being validated somewhat, because I think still it's primarily, you know, a lot of relatively tech-savvy parents see the value of that. But right. It seems like this is becoming more and more of a thing.
Was this survey conducted in the greater Seattle and downtown Silicon Valley areas?
Not necessarily, because I have an interesting counterpoint to this. They went, a whole bunch of places have reported on this, but I read it in The Independent. A thing where CEOs of major tech companies tend to restrict their children's access to technology. So Steve Jobs did it, Bill Gates does it, Zuckerberg does it. They all keep their kids away from tech and want them to read books.
I believe that.
I'm quite prepared to believe that you say, okay, people need to learn digital skills at school so they can go out and get a job, which is less of a problem if you stand to inherit $165 billion, but probably don't need a job. But I thought it was interesting that you've got tech companies, you know, surveys saying people should be learning technology at school and big tech companies should be involved in that. But the people who run those big tech companies are like, no, I don't want my kids involved with it.
I don't think they're saying that. I think you're conflating a few things. I don't think that using your example of big tech companies restricting their kids' screen time is, I don't want my kids involved in this. I don't think restricting screen time involves restricting 100% of coding development screen time.
Also, I think surely the majority of parents restrict it. It's just the degree to which they just restrict it. Like, some parents are at one end where the kids have free rein to use a digital device, whatever that is, and they can put whatever apps on there and play games and watch videos and all that. And then you've got the people at the other end who live in a hut and they don't have any digital devices. And there are people, a myriad of choices in between.
Where
they have a limited amount of screen time, or like only a certain number of hours a day, or maybe only certain applications and no social media and everywhere in between. And I think these CEOs just fall in the very aware of the impact of these things region of that scale.
That's fair. I mean, I'll be honest with you, this is not something I particularly had to address because my daughter's too old. Right? By the time this sort of discussion became a thing, no one ever particularly worried when we were kids about limiting our access to computers or whatever, because there's only so many times you can write more basic programs before you go nuts.
The only thing I got told was you'll get square eyes if you sit that close to the telly.
Exactly. Right?
So, that's medically proven. So there's an article on Mayo Clinic.
Yeah, can I just point out I'm the only one of the three of us who doesn't have square eyes?
The idea that too much screen time is actually damaging, not in a you'll get square eyes point of view, but in the way you view the world and should you step away and digital detoxing and all this kind of thing that we have discussed quite a lot before. That's a relatively recent thing, and it came along with ubiquitous ownership of mobile phones, even by young children. And by the time we got to the stage where that was normal, my daughter was like 16.
So my son messaged me via WhatsApp from his Android device at another location yesterday and said, hey, can I have an Instagram account? And I said, no. not for any other reason than I don't allow you to have an app or a service if you just message me and ask for it. We're going to have a discussion and a conversation about how you use it and limits and all that kind of stuff.
How old's your son?
He'll be 12 next week.
That would be weird to me, having a kid that young on Instagram.
Well, so my daughter had it at this age, which was one of the things, pieces of evidence that he said, well, Sophie had it when she was my age, but she got it when she was in pantomime and all the other dancers that were in the pantomime production all had it, and they all got friends over Instagram, and she signed up without me knowing. So she got it that way. I wouldn't have allowed it at the time, but she's got it now and uses it a lot. But it's, having children of that age where they do sit on their phone all the time, a lot of the time, I can see why people do limit their access.
Totally. I mean, there's a book called The Smart Girl's Guide to Privacy by Violet Blue, which
you can get it on your Kindle.
Written for teenage girls, essentially. Mm-hmm. Practical tips for staying safe online, which I bought for Neve when she was about 12, I think. And it was really good. But at that point, she was quite a trailblazer in terms of actually talking about this sort of thing. Now it's much more part of the zeitgeist.
Mm. Yeah.
But it's going to be interesting to watch you, Jono, because you're those few years behind.
Exactly. Again. Yeah, I'm curious to see what it's going to be like for Jack, because obviously he's completely grown up in this era. So
He's entirely unaware of a world which doesn't have a GPS device in everyone's pocket.
It never ceases to amaze me that when I wanted to play computer games with my friends, I had to take my computer to my friend's house, whereas Sam can sit down at a computer here and log into Discord and have voice chat with his mates who are anywhere in the world and play video games with them online, shooting other people in the face or whatever it is they do. Things have just moved on. I have no idea what it'd be like when Jack gets to Sam's age and like in 6-7 years time and things change again.
Presumably he'll be able to play all the same games but sitting in the back of your flying Cadillac, right? or possibly we'll have just uploaded ourselves into pure energy on the internet version 4 or something.
Well, given the fact that the three of us earlier on were just wowed in how cool it was to zoom into old maps, I'm not sure if we're necessarily the ones to be commenting on the kids of the day.
there does seem to be a certain amount of, discontinuity going on here.
Nice. Well, shall we wrap it up?
Yes,
then?
We shall. We should say thank you very much.
Thank you, Popey.
No worries. Lovely to be here.
Always a pleasure.
Yes.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. And let's try and get you on at some point when Jeremy's on as well, because you're usually a stand-in. But yeah, I know our listeners always enjoy having you on, as do us. And people go and
Do we want to give him 9 seconds to talk about his own podcast? Just so
shill it.
Just so people who listen to Bad Voltage and don't get the opportunity to listen to you again.
Tell us about your podcast and Snappy.
Yeah, we're every week Ubuntu Podcast comes out, and you can find out ubuntupodcast.org, and that's it.
Excellent. You should listen to it.
What an advertising professional.
It's excellent, especially if you want to know how to rebuild a bathroom, which is surprising content for an Ubuntu podcast, but nonetheless.
I think we rank about 28% Ubuntu content by volume in the podcast itself. It's not 100%. It says Ubuntu on the tin, but it very much isn't Ubuntu in the tin.
When you were talking about your... when we were talking about the bathroom remodeling on the Ubuntu podcast, was there an outpour of anger and annoyance when you decided to move the taps from one side of the sink to the other side of the sink?
And we also made them brown as well.
Right.
Never forget. Never forget, people. Never forget.
Right. Thank you very much. that was the show.
Laters.
I am recording.
I am recording.
Do you want an intro, Langridge? Intro the wonder and the wisdom that is Pope.
Oh, for God's sake. Is it episode 38?
Fuck knows.
The problem is it's written at the top of the document, but I can never remember whether I've already changed it or not. Hang on. Badvoltage.org.
Wait, do you use one document and just clear it out and start again?
Yes.
You lazy
Before
fuck.
You joined, there was notes in that document from like 3 years ago.
Yeah. I cleared them all out because I don't want you seeing all the secret things we decided not to do in 2014. Right, yeah, it is episode 38. So I'm introing, am I?
Yes.
Okay. This is Bad Voltage, episode... No, I've fucked that up already, for God's sake. Sorry, Jono.
What a professional. What a professional. Jeremy would be proud.